Thank you, Island family. How old was Caleb when you guys first started at Grace?
One.
There you go. Another pleasure watching a family be raised in our midst. I think it was Lucy Boyson. I think it was the first baby born after I arrived, so that's a joy to watch that. Speaking of the young ones, children are dismissed to Children's Church. And while they're going, turn to Ephesians chapter 4, please. Not everybody wants to go. Well, last two Sundays ago when I was in this passage, this Sunday, and looks like next week as well, we're talking about unity, why unity matters, why it's so absolutely important, and to learn about the things that seek to destroy our unity. And to start off thought this morning, I want to talk about a story that I saw about a sense of belonging, although it's a little bit of dysfunctional belonging. The story goes like this. The lady says, it's a horrible life where she lives. You don't eat, you don't sleep. Any money you get goes on crack, says Felina Drumont. As the article goes on to say, Felina is 26 years old, transgendered, homeless, and addicted to crack. For the last 4 years, she has lived on the streets of an area in central Sao Paulo, Brazil, that has become infamous, called Cracolândia, literally crack land. Thousands upon thousands of people live in this crack land. The article says, for Drumont, despite her 2 months of sobriety, the allure of crack land remained strong. She abandoned her apartment after taking up crack, and like many addicts, most of whom have lost contact with their families, she says crack land's main appeal is its commonly community feel, however dysfunctional. We are like a family of the excluded, she says. What a crazy environment, huh? On the one hand, it's an absolutely horrible, horrible existence. But on the other hand, she almost prefers it to being alone. That tells you the powerful sense of belonging that is within each one of us, that we will choose to belong even over living in insanity. Well, a local church like ours can never fulfill fully that sense of belonging that we all seek. A local church can never meet all of your relational needs. That's foolishness to expect that. However, it can be a place, a powerful place of belonging and wonderful Christian unity, as long as we avoid the things that will kill unity in our midst. And for that, let me read again the end of Ephesians chapter 4 if you want to follow along. I'm picking up at verse 25. See if you can remember these, the five things we covered 2 weeks ago. Therefore, having put away all falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, so that may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you are sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. 2 weeks ago, we spent our time on putting away falsehood and speaking the truth. Remember, all these prohibitions, there's five of them, most of them have a corresponding positive. So you put away falsehood and you put on truth. Most of them are like that. So we're going to keep working through the list, but before we do that, I'm going to go back to falsehood in just for a moment and give you one of four reasons why unity matters. So in this short passage, there's five prohibitions that are unity killers, we can call them, and there's four reasons why unity matters. And the first reason is, for we are members one of another. Put away all falsehood, speak the truth with one another, for we are members one of another. We are to put off falsehood for that reason. We're members of one another. That's the first reason given, that we are blood-bought members of Christ's family, that every one of us who have trusted Christ, who have been brought out of the kingdom of darkness and transferred into the kingdom of his beloved Son. Therefore, why would you lie to one another? Why would you seek to destroy that unity that Christ bought with his blood? And by the way, these four reasons, I don't think apply just to the thing that follows it, but I think all the reasons apply to all of the prohibitions. For example, we are members of one another, therefore, why would we lie to another? Why would we steal from one another? Why would we be bitter and wrathful to one another? All that comes down to our kingdom mindset, that we are members one of another. And remember as well that these are all gospel-motivated prohibitions and positive things to put on. Remember, we've got doctrine, and then we've got application. So the doctrine in this case is he has made us both one from chapter 2. That's what, again, being transferred from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, his beloved Son. That's done. We didn't do that. Christ did that. But because of that, now we put away all falsehood and speak the truth. So Paul is just emphasizing we are members of one another. He's just reemphasizing what he's already covered in chapter 2. So five prohibitions, four reasons for expressing our unity. Number two prohibition, our unity killer, is sinful anger. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. This verse has been talked a lot about and I think ruined as well over the years, over the centuries. Be angry and do not sin. I've seen countless times people rationalize, justify their anger with this verse. Be angry and do not sin. So they think everybody else has anger problems, but their anger, when it is expressed, they think it's usually, you know, what we call righteous anger, righteous indignation, right? I mean, I've seen that guy, Joe, down the block. Every time he tries to start his lawnmower, man, he gets it going. And the words, whoo, I got to cover my ears. It's bad. You know, Joe, he's got a sinful anger problem. Me, yeah, you know, maybe sometimes. You look at the two different translations, ESV, be angry and do not sin, versus the NIV, in your anger do not sin. Almost looks like ESV is a command, right? Be angry, right? And if we cut it off there, it would look like a command. But that clearly is not the intent. Be angry and do not sin. This verse gets real sticky real fast. Not only people try to justify their anger with this verse, but it's real unusual verse because our anger, first of all, is almost always sinful in nature. Almost always sinful. Also, it's unusual because you don't have any of the other prohibitions or unity killers being qualified in the same way. Paul did not say, when you lie, do not sin. He didn't say, when you're bitter and wrathful, don't sin. When you steal, don't sin. Now, why didn't he say those things? Because those things are all sinful in and of themselves. Yet he says, be angry and do not sin. How can he do that? The only way he can possibly do that is the fact that anger is itself not inherently sinful. Lying, stealing, bitterness, those are all inherently sinful. Anger is not inherently sinful. But I think it is safe to say that most of our anger is immediately sinful. Most anger responses that we experience are like a light switch, right? You're just going along and things seem normal and you're calm and something happens and it's like a light switch. Boom! Just like, you know, your anger turns on like a light bulb. That kind of anger is probably sinful the moment it appears. However, Paul is allowing for the possibility that some emotions of anger are righteous in nature. They're not inherently sinful. At least they don't start out as sinful, right? Even the most righteous kind of anger can quickly denigrate into sinful anger. But how do we reconcile this idea of you can be angry, not sin, with a passage like James 1, where it says, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. So I think we'd agree that anger doesn't produce righteousness, but we also have this ability, this possibility that you can be angry and not sin. And I don't think there's a contradiction there. I think you can hold those two, they both can be true at the same time. You can have an occasional righteous anger, but in general, anger does not bring about the righteousness of God. So we can call it righteous anger, righteous indignation, and sometimes it's appropriate. Like if you follow the news this week, Kate Steinle's murderer was acquitted of all charges, if you followed that story at all. And when you see that level of injustice, it's right to become a little bit angry. You realize that's just what they did, and the innocent, not guilty verdict, not innocent, I guess they didn't declare him, but they declared him not guilty, is just wrong. And if that elicits some anger in you, perfectly normal. But of course, we have to be so very careful that our anger is measured and careful with that. But there are times when careful anger can lead to something constructive. that anger can bring about some positive change when all is said and done. So the Bible is allowing for this category of righteous anger. But we have to be so careful in applying that. It's kind of like asking, let's say you suddenly had an appendix attack. And some of you say, well, I can't have one because mine's already gone. But you have an appendix attack and you go to the ER and they give you two choices. You can go with door number one, which is a trained surgeon. He's been doing this for 30 years. He's pulled out 50 appendixes at least. Or door number two, a meat cutter. Now, both have knives. Both cut things, cut through flesh, and the meat cutter could probably at least open you up. I don't know what he or she would do after that. But that's what I'm trying to drive at is, if we're going to say, yes, my anger is righteous, then you better be applying it with the skill of a surgeon. That's how careful you have to be. Otherwise, it's like your anger is like hacking a meat cutter, hacking at an appendix. It's not a pretty sight. This famous verse of Paul's is actually taken from Psalm 4. The first half is exactly the same as Ephesians. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Very similar. And I think what Paul is probably kind of paraphrasing with the second half, do not let the sun go down your anger. He's thinking about the second half of Psalm 4:4. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. So in other words, you're angry and you're on your bed and it's nighttime and you're supposed to work that out. You're supposed to ponder what's going on. Why am I so angry? What's happened here? What am I going to do with this anger? And it's the idea of not letting the sun go down on your anger. You see how those two passages go together very well. Because if your anger lingers while you're still in your bed before the sun goes down, what happens the next morning? You're still angry. Yeah, you're still angry. Now, there might be an occasion that you went to bed and you got your feathers all ruffled and you wake up in the morning and you're like, ah, that was no big deal, you know, I'm over it. But sometimes you wake up and you're worse, right? It kind of brewed overnight and that's what happens, right? In the springtime, we go plant a seed, and if you plant a seed during the daytime and you go to bed at night, what's going to happen by the next morning? That little seed has sprouted. It's not a plant yet, but it's sprouted. It began to grow. It's germinating. It's going to grow. It will take root. It's going to grow probably very slowly, but it's already started. And the same thing is with our anger. If we're not dealing with it, if we're not pondering it on our beds and our hearts, then we've already planted that seed. And where is that seed? It's right here, isn't it? It's right in our hearts. It's taken root in our minds. There are other passages that speak of the wisdom of not letting the sun go down on certain things. Deuteronomy 24. You shall give him his wages on the same day before the sun sets, for he is poor and counts on it, lest he cry against you to the Lord and you be guilty of sin. Now, of course, in this context, these were what they are called day laborers, right? Which is still true in many parts of the world, very poor parts of the world. You go and you work a job, you're hired for that one day, you get paid for that one day. The next day, you don't know where you're going to work or where your money's going to come from. So you've got to pay people on the day they work. There is no check, you know, a paycheck coming in every 2 weeks, or if you're self-employed, some big check, and then you got to wait a while, then another big check. None of that's happening. You work, you get paid. You work, you get paid. Now, if there's a slight delay, you know, maybe the landowner is the work is done and he's got to do some things and gather money, and maybe there's an hour or two delay, that's okay. But if the sun sets and those workers have not been paid, that's sin. Now you're into the realm of clear sin. Same thing is described, Paul here, I think, is describing with our anger. You know, if there's a little bit of a delay, maybe there's righteous indignation there. Maybe there's something that there's going to be something positive come out of this. But if the sun sets, right, if there's a delay, now you're into sinful anger. By the way, I think that's one of the ways to know if you're dealing with righteous anger or sinful anger, does it persist or not? Now, I realize there's some things that, you know, are traumatic and are really hard to deal with, and you might have to just go back, you know, over and over, right? I'm angry, I deal with it, I'm angry, I deal with it. That kind of cycle can be necessary. Sometimes you just get stuck, and that's not positive, but some really painful things can be necessary. I realize you're not necessarily going to let go of it all at once, and that's gone forever. So that can happen. But in general, it's a good indicator. If you go to bed, you're still angry, it's almost certainly sinful anger. Something to keep in mind. So Paul's paraphrase there, I think, is a good paraphrase of Psalm chapter 4. And this prohibition has a larger purpose attached to it, what we're calling one of the four reasons for unity. It says, give no opportunity to the devil. Be angry, do not sin, do not let the sun go down in your anger. Give no opportunity to the devil. What he's saying is here, why would you hand your enemy a weapon? You just don't do that in warfare. Jesus said that the devil comes only to steal and what? And kill and destroy. So when you're sinfully angry, you've just handed the greatest enemy in all the universe a powerful weapon against you. And you said, here, kill me. Destroy me. I've just handed you that. And destroy and kill the people that I'm angry at. Right? We are at war with the devil. Do you understand that? Do you understand that in all the universe, apart from God, there is no power greater than Satan? And every time you're angry, you've just handed him a weapon to be used against you. A strategic advantage. It's like what happened to Napoleon. This is an infographic of Napoleon's Russian campaign, 1812 to 1813. And the tan lines there represent the 442,000 troops that left France. And as they march across Europe, their numbers keep getting slimmer and slimmer. they're decreased by more than half by the time he gets to Moscow. And then on the way back, and by the time they get back to France, 10,000 troops left. Napoleon lost 98% of his troops because on the battlefield, the enemy always had an advantage. You give your enemy an advantage, and he will decimate you. This is the advantage that our anger gives to the greatest enemy in the universe. When you're angry like that, it's like handing North Korea the codes to your nuclear arsenal. It doesn't make any sense. Why would we do that? The devil is our enemy. He wants to take advantage of our anger. But listen, the devil did not make you angry, all right? We got to get rid of this idea. The devil made me do it. We got to dispel that notion within Christianity. So where does your anger come from? Well, it was my wife then. The devil didn't do me, but it was my husband, my children. Woo, boy, they can really make us angry, right? No. It's not the devil, it's not your spouse, it's not your children, it's not that nutty guy at work. God, James 1 tells us, When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then, after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. There's the answer. We are dragged away from within. It comes from within. One of my favorite pictures. This was, if you know me, those that know me well, know my expertise with the fishing rod. Right? Where's Brian Larrington? Fraser first. There he is, right? You know full well my expertise. My lack of expertise with the fishing rod. But clearly, look at that fish. This was the best fishing day of my entire life. I, like many of us, I don't like to fish, but I like to catch fish, right? There's a big, big difference between those two things. And Robert Storbakken, Sarah Farrell's dad, took us to this secret fishing hole. Secret fishing hole. I'm not going to tell you where it is. And it was a glorious day. It was a glorious day. So I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to tell you, well, eventually I will, how we caught the fish. But let me tell you what we didn't use to catch that string of fish. We never tied a tin can to the end of the fishing line and threw it out in the water. Not once. Not once did we take broken glass and tie it to the line and throw it into the water. I testify, I swear to you, not once did I put ibuprofen on the end of that line to try to catch fish. Why? Because fish have no internal desire for tin cans and broken glass and over-the-counter medication. They just don't. They have no desire for such things. But when you stick a juicy worm on the end of your hook and throw it into a secret fishing hole, those fish jump onto your stringer just like that. It's easy. They are drawn away and enticed by those juicy worms. No matter what I do, I can't entice them to bite on a tin can. And no matter what I do, I can't take away the fact that they want to eat the juicy worms. It's just not in them to be enticed by those crazy things, but it is by the obvious things. And in the same way, when we get angry, we are drawn away and enticed to sin because guess what? That's within us. We have this, as the fish have a hunger and an appetite for worms, we have a hunger and appetite for this particular sin. Now, you can fill in the blank if whatever sin comes out of you, it's not just anger, but it's the same process. It comes from within you. And if it wasn't within you, it wouldn't come out of you. Jesus said that very same thing. This is why no one can make you angry. Now, you've got people that can be difficult and circumstances that can be difficult. And Dave Hart calls those things what? Triggers, right? We should all know that. Those are triggers. They can elicit the anger. They can tempt you to anger, but they cannot make you angry. So we've got to stop saying so-and-so or such a thing made me angry. When you're drawn away and enticed toward anger, it's like a fish jumping after a juicy worm. The devil cannot make you angry, but he can use your anger for his evil purposes. So if this comes from within me and I realize you don't like to hear that, it's easier to say, you know, it's somebody else's fault. If this comes from within me, and including all my sins come within me, how in the world do I get so enticed? Why am I so easily enticed? Well, part of the answer comes a little bit later in the chapter, where Paul says, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Anger, you notice, is listed twice in this passage. It's the only prohibition, the only sin that's mentioned twice. Why is it mentioned twice? Because that's what happens, right? If you don't deal with the anger before you go to bed, if you don't ponder it and work it out, it's going to lead to bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander and malice. That's why it's twice in this passage, which is yet another reason why we need to deal with it early on and why that most of our anger is clearly not righteous anger. And speaking of bitterness, classic text is Hebrews 12. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many are defiled. See, these deeper roots that the writer here is talking about are the roots that cause us to be so easily enticed to anger. These are the roots that lie beneath us in our hearts and they cause us to develop a taste, right? We're enticed. We've got this hunger for anger or the sin or whatever it is because it's been cultivated within us. Remember we planted that seed in the springtime? Remember that seed that germinated? Well, that seed is growing and it's growing and sometimes we knowingly, we've watered that thing and we made sure we open the curtain and get sun on it and we care for that bitter root that's growing and growing and it leads to malice and wrath and all those other things. If it wasn't within us, it wouldn't come out of us. Let me give you some steps for working through this. One, just admit it. Whether it's a small problem, I've yet to meet a Christian that doesn't sometimes have an issue with this, right? It just doesn't exist. If you've met somebody, I want to meet him or her. Admit your anger, even if it doesn't seem like a big deal. Second of all, don't make excuses. Stop blaming the devil and everybody else. If it wasn't within you, it wouldn't come out of you. Third, realize the advantage you are yielding to the devil. And remember also, it's worse than that because there's this vicious circle. Because you're tempted from without. Satan does that. That's what he loves to do. You're tempted from without, but you're enticed from within. That's within you. And then you're trapped. And then it starts all over. You're tempted, enticed, and trapped. And it's not just a circle, is it? It's a spiral. It's a downward spiral. And you say, how do I ever break this cycle? Well, one of the things you got to do is admit it. Don't make excuses for it. And then the moment it rears up, and I'm talking about immediately, this sort of thing, again, with any sin, is so important to deal with it. The moment it rears up, you just own it, okay? I mean, so what's the difference between number one and this point? I'm talking about doing it right away, not tomorrow, not next week, admitting it right in the moment, dealing with it right away, and then apologize immediately to everyone involved, right? If you blurted something out and 10 people heard you, you got to tell 10 people that you did this thing. Or if there's one person, admit it right away, apologize right away. See, this breaks the power of the sin, of any sin. Confession, that's part of the reason we're supposed to confess our sins to one another. It begins to break the power over it. Ask God to reveal why you got angry right then. So what you're asking him is, Lord, why am I so enticed? Right? Because I know Bob down the street, and I work with Bob, and we're under the same circumstances at work, and I tend to get angry, and I look at Bob, and he seems fine. Why, Lord, am I so easily enticed to anger, Lord? I don't understand it. I need you to tell me what's going on. Right? And if we don't have some understanding, I'm not saying, you know, you've got to like work through 50 years of issues before maybe, but it could be one, two, three things or one major thing in your past. But Lord, tell me why I'm so easily enticed. It reminds me of all of the junk that's going on and every day. Celebrities and politicians are implicated more and more, and it's an unprecedented revealing of junk that doesn't seem to be slowing down, does it? It just seems like this giant boulder that's going downhill and it's picking up speed, and there's a lot of hypocrisy associated with it, and I get that. But I think in general, what we're witnessing is by and large a positive thing. This revealing of sin, and I think what's surprised a lot of us is that some of these women and some men have not talked about it, right? That they've kind of been silent about it, maybe have driven it deep down into their hearts and minds, and now the occasion is that it's being brought up, and you say, how could that be silent for so long? How could they not reveal those things? Well, that's what trauma is like, right? That's kind of the nature of trauma. When I say trauma, it could be a whole spectrum of things. You could be a young child, and dad or mom are just like goes off the handle one day and is just like screaming at you, and maybe it was out of character for them, and you remember that. You could even carry that one thing with you for the rest of your life. It's a little bit of trauma associated with that. Or you're a young child, and your best friend at school just really turns his or her back on you, and you're never friends again, and that's painful. There's some trauma associated with that. Or then, of course, you get into some really wicked and awful things that probably some of you have experienced. And we all have levels of trauma, and we deal differently with them. And I think some of those can get buried down deep within us, and we're not aware of it. So we need God to tell us what we don't know. We need Him to tell us what we don't know. That's what I love about Psalm 139. Wait, what's the end of Psalm 139? Help me out, somebody. That's not creating me a clean heart. It's. Give it to me. Let me get this. End of Psalm 139. I thought it would come to me, and it's not. Search me, O God, and know my wicked thoughts. See if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. That's a rough paraphrase. But it comes at the end of Psalm 139. But if you read the rest of Psalm 139, it's all about how thoroughly God knows us. All right? That's created in my mother's womb. I was knit together. It doesn't matter where I go. If I go to the far ends of the sea, you are there. The whole psalm is, the psalmist is saying, God, you know me perfectly, and you've always known me. So why at the end of the psalm does it say, search me and know me? See if there's any wicked. Why is that at the end of the psalm? What the psalmist is saying is, Lord, tell me what you already know. Do you see how that works? God knows us perfectly. He's not surprised. So the prayer is, God, tell me what you already know. That's all I'm saying here. Why am I so enticed to this? Lord, tell me what you already know, because I don't know, and I need a supernatural power to tell me, and I've got to know this so I can begin to break the power over this. And then ultimately, the great power comes, and we're going to deal with this more thoroughly next week, is the second half of that verse. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. So the power of Christ's forgiveness in your life, which breaks those bonds, which breaks those chains, and then allows forgiveness to come out of you and begins to break that power of anger as well. We'll talk about some more of that next week. But if you think about it, this entire message is a preview for the Lord's Supper, isn't it? We're talking about these are unity killers. And the Lord's Supper is not only unity, but it is unity, isn't it? We remember Christ's sacrifice, and what did Christ's sacrifice do? Took us out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his beloved Son. The blood bought unity. And when we say, yeah, oh, I love the fact that Jesus died for me, I don't like the fact I've got to get along with so-and-so. That's a problem. That's a big problem. That's why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 that some believers, what? Died for this problem, all right? They were so unwilling to be unified. They were holding things against people, and there was divisions among them such that people died. That's discipline at the greatest level. I'm not suggesting that's going to happen. I'm just saying that's what's in the Word of God. And sometimes we've got to see that powerful warning, that powerful reminder. So we say, yes, Lord, I'm so grateful for what you've done. And yes, Lord, I'm so grateful that what you did has brought us into unity. So we've kind of prepared, hopefully, our hearts for the Lord's Supper.